Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It was a wicked time in my life. It was a really scary time in my life. I had just been abused by a member of a royal family. So when you talk about these chains, you know, yeah, I wasn't chained to a sink, but these powerful people were my chains. I didn't know what could happen.
Those are the words of the late Virginia Giuffre, who survived sexual abuse at the hands of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Virginia died by suicide in April. But before her death, she wrote a 400-page book detailing how, as a teenager, she was trafficked to Prince Andrew and other powerful men, including an unnamed former prime minister who raped her. As Republicans refuse to release the full Epstein files, we'll speak to Amy Wallace, who collaborated with Virginia on the book Nobody's Girl.
This book is about the fetishization of young women. This book is about powerful people who get to hurt people less powerful and not pay any price for it. I think that's why so many people are clamoring for the Epstein file release, because they're sick of it.
Then we look at the escalating tension between the U.S. and Colombia. After Colombian President Gustavo Petro condemned the U.S. for blowing up boats in the Caribbean.
I am making no mistake by speaking to the world from Colombia, because what I am demonstrating is that Colombia is the heart of the world, and aggression against Colombia is aggression against the heart of the world. I call on the world to help us.
We'll speak to Colombia's ambassador to the United States, who was recalled to Bogota after President Trump threatened to cut off aid to Colombia and impose new tariffs. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing its deadly attacks in Gaza, despite the U.S.-brokered ceasefire. Al Jazeera's reporting hospitals in Gaza received 13 bodies over the past day that Palestinians say they've seen no real change in their lives since the ceasefire. The Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis is reporting Israel's handed over 30 bodies and remains of slain Palestinians. Hamas has handed over the bodies of 15 Israeli hostages as part of the ceasefire deal. On Wednesday, a funeral was held for 54 unidentified Palestinians returned by Israel. It comes as the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says the amount of aid currently entering Gaza is a, quote, drop in the ocean of what's urgently needed. Here's Abir Atifa of the World Food Program.
Since the ceasefire started on the 11th of October, we've now have over 530 trucks into Gaza, supporting bakeries, nutrition programs, general food distributions. So far, we've had over 6,700 tons of food. That's enough for close to 500,000 people for 2 weeks. Daily deliveries continue, and they are now averaging around 750 tons. That's much better than what we had before the ceasefire, but it's still well below our target, which is around 2,000 tons every day.
The Palestinian Prisoner Society says Israeli forces have detained 45 people, including a child, in raids since last night in the occupied West Bank. The group describes Israeli forces have vandalized homes and repeatedly assaulted detainees and their relatives. It comes as the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied Palestinian territory is warning about an alarming rise in Israeli settler violence against Palestinians as the olive harvest season gets underway. So far this year, there were over 750 Israeli settler attacks on Palestinians, which is a 13% increase from last year. On Tuesday, a panel of judges from the Philadelphia-based Third Circuit Court of Appeals appeared skeptical of the Trump administration's attempt to rearrest and deport Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil. The Columbia University graduate was the first pro-Palestinian campus protester to be jailed by the Trump administration over his advocacy work. Khalil's lawyers have filed appeals to prevent the Trump administration from detaining him again. Yesterday, Khalil spoke to supporters outside the federal court.
I have to say things like this shows how my case is actually just like a test for everyone's rights here across the country.
The federal government shutdown has entered its 22nd day. Earlier this week, the federal judiciary ran out of funding to support the work of nearly 30,000 staffers and 94 district courts. Some of these courts are furloughing staff for the first time in 30 years. It comes as several states are warning they'll be forced to suspend Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that's SNAP benefits, by November 1st if the shutdown continues, impacting an estimated 42 million people nationwide. Meanwhile, at a White House Rose Garden lunch for Republican senators yesterday, President Trump unveiled a new nickname for Russ Vought, the White House budget chief, who has been spearheading cuts to programs nationwide amidst the shutdown.
And I will say this, that we have Darth Vader. You know Darth Vader, right? Darth Vader is a man who, I think he's sitting right. Is that Darth? Stand up, please, Darth Vader. Stand up. Does everybody know? This is, they call him Darth Vader. I call him a fine man. But he's cutting Democrat priorities, and they're never going to get him back.
A January 6th rioter who was pardoned by President Trump has been rearrested for allegedly threatening to assassinate House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries. Christopher Moynihan reportedly sent text to an unidentified recipient, including, quote, Hakeem Jeffries makes a speech in a few days in NYC. I cannot allow this terrorist to live. And, quote, I will kill him for the future, unquote. Moynihan is among the 1,500 people who participated in the January 6th riots, who were later granted clemency by Trump when he returned to office. In a highly unusual move, President Trump's demanding the Justice Department pay him about $230 million in compensation for the federal probes against him. Many of the senior DOJ officials who would be needed to approve such a payout previously worked for Trump, including the Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, his former private attorney. The White House said they would, quote, follow the guidance of career ethics officials. But Attorney General Pam Bondi fired the agency's top ethics advisor in July. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays is suing Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson for refusing to swear in Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva. In the filing, Mays wrote, quote, constitutional rights cannot be used as a bargaining chip, unquote. Mays is asking the court to force Speaker Johnson to swear in Grijalva or designate someone else to do it. By refusing to seat her, Speaker Johnson is depriving 813,000 residents living in Arizona's 7th District of congressional representation. Grijalva says she believes Speaker Johnson's refusing to swear her in to Congress because she would be the final vote on a discharge petition to release the Epstein files. We'll have more on that after headlines. President Trump's nominee to lead the Office of Special Counsel, Paul Ingrassia, withdrew from consideration Tuesday following widespread backlash over a slew of racist and anti-Semitic texts. Ingrassia texted a group of Republicans that he has a, quote, Nazi streak, adding that the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday should be, quote, tossed into the seventh circle of hell, unquote. After the texts were made public by Politico Monday, several Republican senators say they would not support his nomination, including Senate Majority Leader John Thune. As immigration raids ramp up across the country, ICE agents in Los Angeles shot and wounded two people in a botched operation Tuesday. The agents reportedly shot an immigrant from Mexico they were attempting to arrest. A bullet then ricocheted and wounded a U.S. Marshal. The person ICE targeted has been identified as Carlitos Ricardo Parias, who is a popular TikTok streamer with over 100,000 followers and often documents ICE raids. He now faces criminal charges. Here in New York, dozens of federal agents, many of them with face coverings, flooded Lower Manhattan Tuesday afternoon as they targeted immigrant street vendors, most of them from Africa. As news spread of the raid, several people took to the streets in protest. An expose by The Washington Post has revealed Secretary of State Marco Rubio agreed to return nine leaders of the MS-13 gang in U.S. custody to El Salvador in exchange for President Nayib Bukele's government to allow the U.S. deport and detain hundreds of immigrants at the Saycot mega prison complex. Some of the people Rubio promised to return were U.S. government informants who were under the protection of the Justice Department. Bukele's request came amidst mounting reports of secret deals between his government and MS-13. UN experts say U.S. strikes against Venezuela in international waters amount to extrajudicial executions. It comes amidst new reporting that the CIA has played a central role in collecting and sharing the bulk of the intelligence used by the Trump administration to carry out its deadly extrajudicial military strikes in the Caribbean. That's according to reports from The Guardian, which spoke to sources close to the operations who said the CIA is providing real-time information collected by satellites and signal intercepts to target boats they believe are carrying drugs. CIA agents then make the recommendation to strike the vessels with missiles. The U.S. has blown up at least seven boats in the region, killing over two dozen people, without providing evidence that the vessels are in fact used for drug trafficking. Meanwhile, President Trump's continued his attacks on Colombia and Venezuela. This is Venezuelan Defense Minister Vladimir Petrino.
Colombia must know it can count on the Bolivarian National Armed Forces. The people of Colombia must know that they have on their side moral and physical support and deployment of our force and our territory to defend against all threats that loom over the border.
Russian airstrikes killed seven people, including two children in Ukraine today. It comes as President Trump announced his upcoming summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Budapest has been canceled, telling reporters he did not want to, quote, have a wasted meeting. Both Trump and European leaders are calling on Russia to accept a ceasefire along the current front lines. So far, the Kremlin has rejected those calls. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says it isn't surprising Russia's refused to negotiate.
Instead, Russia is once again doing anything to avoid diplomacy. And as soon as the question of long-range weapons for us, for Ukraine, moved away, Russia almost automatically became less interested in diplomacy.
Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy turned himself in to prison authorities on Tuesday to begin serving a five-year sentence. Last month, he was found guilty of criminal conspiracy for illegally receiving millions of euros from the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to fund his 2007 campaign. Sarkozy is the first former French head of state in the modern era to be convicted of a crime. In Colombia, an appeals court has overturned the conviction of former president and U.S. ally Álvaro Uribe for witness tampering and bribery. Uribe had been sentenced to 12 years of house arrest for allegedly bribing imprisoned members of paramilitary groups to retract damaging testimony exposing Uribe's ties to right-wing U.S.-backed paramilitary groups. Uribe ruled Colombia from 2002 to 2010, during which time there were thousands of extrajudicial killings of civilians who were then purposely mislabeled as rebel fighters in what became known as the false positive scandal. We'll talk more about this later in the broadcast. And indigenous leaders from across Latin America have embarked on a flotilla from the banks of the Napo River in Cauca, Ecuador, as they sail to Belém, Brazil, for the UN Climate Summit, set to begin next month. Members of the Yakumama Amazon Flotilla are demanding an end to fossil fuels, protections for indigenous territories and ecosystems from oil, mining, and industrial agriculture, and a ban on fossil fuel extraction in the Amazon rainforest. Democracy Now! Will be in Belém, broadcasting from the COP30. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays is suing Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson for refusing to swear in Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva, who was elected a month ago in a special election to represent more than 800,000 people of the greater Tucson area. Grijalva says she believes Speaker Johnson is refusing to seat her because she would be the final vote necessary on a discharge petition to release unclassified records about convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Last week, the House Oversight Committee released a new set of Epstein documents, including call logs that included someone listed as Donald Trump. As all of this unfolded Tuesday, an explosive memoir was released by Jeffrey Epstein's survivor, the late Virginia Roberts Giuffre, titled Nobody's Girl, a memoir of surviving abuse and fighting for justice. Virginia was the first survivor to come out publicly against Epstein. In the book, she details how he groomed her along with his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, who met Virginia while she worked at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. Maxwell is currently serving a 20-year sentence for sex trafficking. Giuffre writes, quote, in my years with them, they lent me out to scores of wealthy, powerful people. I was habitually used and humiliated, and in some instances, choked, beaten, and bloodied. I believed I might die as a sex slave, she said. Virginia also details how she was forced to have sex with Prince Andrew three times, beginning when she was 17. Virginia also said she was beaten and raped by a well-known prime minister. Virginia Giuffre died reportedly by suicide earlier this year in Australia at age 41. Nobody's Girl was completed just before she died. In the book's foreword, her collaborator, Amy Wallace, describes an email from Virginia shortly before she died that read in part, quote, the content of this book is crucial as it aims to shed light on the systemic failures that allow the trafficking of vulnerable individuals across borders. It's imperative that the truth is understood and that the issues surrounding this topic are addressed both for the sake of justice and awareness. In the event of my passing, I would like to ensure that Nobody's Girl is still released, she said. For more, we're joined here in our New York studio by Amy Wallace, the ghostwriter of Virginia Roberts Giuffre's posthumously published memoir this week, Nobody's Girl, a memoir of surviving abuse and fighting for justice. Amy Wallace's op-ed in Sunday's New York Times is headlined, Why Virginia Roberts Giuffre Would Not Stop Talking About Jeffrey Epstein. We welcome you to Democracy Now! This book is utterly painful. The cover, a photograph of a young Virginia disappearing, fading. If you can start off by talking about this horror that she underwent that is rocking both Britain right now and the United States and the U.S., it may well be why Congress has not resumed working. And of course, right now, you have the situation just before the two of your book was released. Prince Andrew has voluntarily given up his title is because of what's being released in this book. Why don't you start off by talking about how Virginia Giuffre came to work at Mar-a-Lago as a underage young woman, and then ultimately was trafficked by both Maxwell and Epstein.
Yeah, well, she was 16 years old. She was working a summer job at Mar-a-Lago. She was working in the spa, so there was a particular section of the hotel that she worked in. Her father worked at Mar-a-Lago as a maintenance man, and he helped her get the job. A man who abused her as well, which she reveals in this book for the first time. And we can talk about that more. But, yeah, she was about a couple weeks into the job, but she loved working there. It was a beautiful place. She felt really privileged to be there. And a posh British woman walks in with an amazing outfit and very attractive. I think Virginia writes that her handbag cost more than my dad's truck. There was a class issue here, clearly. And the woman sees her reading an anatomy book and says, oh, are you interested in massage? And Virginia says, well, I don't really know much about it, but I'm so inspired by this spa. I would love to learn. And she is asked to then go that day to Epstein's house She goes because a woman has asked her, and she thinks it's going to be safe. And that very day, hours later, Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein sexually abused her for the first time, and at that point, she was in the net.
And how did she go from Mar-a-Lago to then being close to and in the circle of Epstein?
Well, I think, you know, there were different victims that were treated differently. There were some girls that went one time to the house in Palm Beach and then were never seen again. And then there were other girls who were in the sort of inside circle. And Virginia lived very close by when she first met him. She lived in Loxahatchee, which is a sort of more rural, poorer area. She lived with her parents in a trailer in the back. And he liked her. I think that he could spot. He and Ghislaine both were very good at sniffing out girls who had already been abused and who were more vulnerable to being manipulated. And so he quickly absorbed her into his world, told her to quit her job at Mar-a-Lago. He would rent her an apartment. He didn't want her living with her parents anymore because he wanted her to come and go at all hours. He didn't want her parents to be suspicious. So very quickly she gets pulled in, and then they say, you know, you don't have a passport. We need to get you one of those. And Ghislaine Maxwell helps her fill out the application. And then they take her to London. That's really one of her first major trips. Certainly, she'd never been abroad before. They take her to London, and that's where she's first trafficked to Prince Andrew. She had already been, by that point, trafficked to other friends of Epstein and Maxwell. So it was a pretty quick sort of itinerary on her going into the depths of hell. She quickly becomes one of their people that travels with them all over the world.
Now, in the book, she does not name many of those who she says sexually assaulted her, but you know all of them because you fact-checked them. Is there anything that you have to say about that, or is there the reason those names were not disclosed?
Yeah, I think Virginia is pretty eloquent about this in the book. But, you know, any survivor of sexual abuse understands that coming forward, you have sort of a cost-reward ratio that you're weighing. You know you want to hold these people accountable for what they did to you, but you also know that's going to come at a cost. Your privacy, obviously, but also in the case of Virginia, some of these men had threatened her. Some of these men had threatened her physically. She'd had death threats that the FBI found credible and called her, and she and her family rented a camper van in Australia where they lived and fled into the wilds of Australia for 3 weeks to try to figure out what to do next. So there were real risks and legal risks. There were people that said to her, basically, it doesn't matter what you say or what's true, we're going to keep you in court for the rest of your life if you don't take our names out of your mouth. So there were a lot of decisions that she had to make about what names were going to go in. There are new names there, but there are names left out. I guess what I would add to that is that this book was never intended to be a list of names. If you want a list of names, you can go to the Epstein files, and they are there. Not just Virginia's names, and I know all of the ones that she told the FBI repeatedly, but other victims have bravely come forward. And this investigation has been going on for many, many years since the first time that Epstein was arrested and charged back in 2000, I believe, 8. There's a lot of information there. And this is what my op-ed in the New York Times is about, to put the burden always on victims, the weakest among us who've already been hurt, to make them repeat on demand instead of having law enforcement do its job. And I think that's why a lot of the American public is calling for the release of the Epstein files.
In the book, Virginia writes that she was beaten and raped by a well-known prime minister. I think the British version of the book says minister. This is prime minister. Who is she talking about?
Well, I can't reveal any of the names that are not in the book. I mean, and I'll tell you a couple of reasons why. One, this is Virginia's book. And these were decisions that she had to make for her safety, but also the safety of her family. And just because Virginia is gone does not mean her family is not in danger. Some of these people are scary. So I respect her choices. I guess that's the short answer. It's her book, and we're not going to go any farther than that. There are names that she has named in public depositions. There are 4 document dumps. I've read all of them. And there are names there. The names have been released by others at times. So the names are out there. But
one
again,
of the names that is mentioned in these document dumps is the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who is close to Jeffrey Epstein.
Yes, his name is mentioned in the document dumps.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about what's happening right now with Prince Andrew. He is voluntarily, supposedly, on the eve of the release of Nobody's Girl, voluntarily given up his titles. But the king could strip him of his title, right? His father. Mm-hmm. I mean, his brother.
His brother.
His
yes.
brother. he clearly, and she describes the encounters with him. She describes being raped by him the third time in an orgy in Jeffrey Epstein's island in the Caribbean with young women, girls who couldn't even speak English because they were from another place. She said Jeffrey liked them that way because they were easier to deal with. But he clearly knew her age, right? Because at the beginning, when he was with Ghislaine Maxwell, is that Jeffrey Epstein who took the famous picture with Ghislaine in the background and Andrew with his brother, Prince Andrew, still with his arm around Virginia?
Yes. I mean, the backstory around that photo is that Virginia always traveled with point-and-shoot disposable cameras because she was about to be going around the world. She'd never traveled in this way. She was not a person of means. Her family was not wealthy. So she traveled with these little, you know, disposable cameras. And when Ghislaine had woken her up that morning and said, you know, get up, sleepyhead. We're going to have an amazing day. You're going to meet a prince today. And she took her shopping and she bought her outfits. And Virginia chose the outfit that is in that picture. And so when he comes, when the prince comes and she's introduced to him, she realizes, and we say this in the book, you know, my mom would kill me if I met a prince and didn't get a picture of it. So she runs into her room and she gets her camera and she hands it to Epstein, and Epstein takes the picture. I mean, remember, this is a young woman. She is 17 at that point. When she was a child, she watched Cinderella, the movie Cinderella, on repeat. Meeting a prince was a big deal. These were supposed to be the best of us.
Why did Prince Andrew know her age even before she said it?
Well, there was a game that Ghislaine Maxwell played where she would often ask people to guess the ages of the girls. And in this particular case, as we relate in the book, she says to Andrew, guess her age. And he guesses correctly, 17, and then explains why he did so well at this game, because he says, you're around the age of my daughters. I think his daughters were a little bit younger. So the key thing there is he knew how old she was. And, I think if you could line up all the men that Virginia was trafficked to and ask them why they did it, I think some of them would probably try to use as an excuse, well, we didn't know they were underage. In this case, we have a direct connection between his consciousness of her age and the reality. And that's just sort of an amazing detail in the book.
And we should say Prince Andrew denies all of this, but I'm
going to give it to Juan. Prince Andrew continues to deny all of this. He has settled a lawsuit when she sued him for raping and battering her. He settled that lawsuit.
For millions of dollars.
I don't know the amount.
Juan.
I wanted to ask you about Ghislaine Maxwell. She was not just a procurer of victims as well. She was a direct abuser of these women as well. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. I'm not quite sure how the narrative on Ghislaine Maxwell has somehow shifted, even though she's been convicted in a court of law of being a key member of this sexual trafficking scheme. Somehow people have started to think that maybe she's like just a receptionist or, you know, she was keeping the date book. This was a woman who abused girls herself, didn't just procure, which is evil enough, using her gender to lure girls into this net.
Poor
she did
girls.
That. Poor girls. particularly. There were a few that weren't, but most were poor. But then she not only participated in the initial sort of initiation of these girls into the massage room and all the sex and abuse that came there, but she would then demand that they service her sexually. She would hurt them during sex. I mean, Virginia tells a story about being hurt with a ghastly sex toy that Ghislaine was using.